morning. I'd like to call the meeting to order of the Minnesota Senate Health and Human Services Committee. It's Thursday, April 3rd, 2025. Excuse me, and we do have a quorum present. Our first bill on the agenda is Senator Weber, Senate File 2815. Senator Weber.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for hearing Senate File 2815, and thank you to my co-authors, Senators Utke, Klein, and Carlson. This bill basically deals with the Minnesota Provider or Minnesota Care Pharmacy Tax refund. Obviously, I don't need to explain to you about the Minnesota Provider Tax and what it does. But the one element that has existed is that the under Section 295.52, the 1.8% tax that is collected is retained by the state of Minnesota for a year. And the pharmacies may then, who collect this tax on the Legend drugs, then have an annual opportunity to apply for the refund. And quite frankly, we have the company, for example, whose representative is sitting next to me and will testify also, has at some locations up to 98% of their sales are to clients, patients outside of the state of Minnesota. And it of course, is the refund of those sales tax dollars that are allowed to be applied for in terms of a refund. As a result of that, there begins to be a fairly substantial amount of money that is retained by the state of Minnesota. And sometimes to the point where even those pharmacies need to actually go out and obtain loans to conduct their business and to have their operating capital on hand. And so Sterling, which is Sterling Specialty Pharmacy, has worked with the Commissioner of Revenue and his staff to develop a plan whereby this could now become a quarterly refund rather than an annual refund. And that, Madam Chair and members, is what the purpose of Senate File 2815 is. It would allow them to get their refund on a quarterly basis, thereby keeping them from times from having to get a loan and certainly assist them. And they have worked with the department. They have language that has been agreed to by the department. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll be available for questions, but I would turn the testifiers table over to Randy Schindelar from Sterling Specialty Pharmacy.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Randy Schindelar. Good morning, Chair Wicklund and members of the Health and Human Services Committee. My name is Randy Schindelar, and I am the Chief Financial Officer at Astrup Companies and Sterling Specialty Pharmacy. Astrup Companies has been in business over 72 years, has become a staple in rural Minnesota under the Sterling brand, and now operates 13 retail pharmacies and 4 long-term care pharmacies, and a specialty pharmacy in Mendota Heights. Over 400 Minnesotans are employed by Astrup Companies today, and the company is now run by second and third generation family members. 8 years ago, we opened Sterling Specialty Pharmacy. The drugs dispensed out of this pharmacy are sent directly to patients in all 50 states out of our facility in Mendota Heights. Somewhat unique to Sterling Specialty Pharmacy is that close to 99% of our medications purchased are then sent directly to patients outside of Minnesota. This is significant because the state of Minnesota places the 1.8% MinCare Legend drug tax on every medication purchased, even if 99% of the medications sold by our pharmacy are for patients outside of Minnesota. As you guys are all probably aware, the way the Minnesota Care Legend drug tax works is drug wholesalers that sell prescription drugs to Sterling Specialty charge the tax on 100% of purchases and remit those taxes to the Minnesota Department of Revenue, even though only 1% of the company's purchases will be used to serve Minnesotans. The amounts withheld create a significant cash flow burden on our company until the tax can be trued up upon annual filing, and 99% of the amounts withheld are refunded to the company once per year. As demonstrated in the handout, this amounted to $1.51 million in taxes withheld in 2024. Even though the company only had $42,000 in net tax obligations. The $1.47 million difference was recently refunded by the state through the annual MinCare tax filing. Since a refund can only be requested annually, it has put a significant burden on the company's cash flow. In 2024, the company obtained an external credit facility, a loan, to mitigate this impact at market rates of interest that impact our operating costs significantly. We set out this year working with Senator Weber to seek a reasonable solution that maintains the spirit and substance of the existing law, but provides relief to companies like ours that have large amounts withheld that are not a true net tax obligation. We worked with Commissioner Marquardt's office to see if we could change the annual refund to a quarterly refund opportunity. This change will go a long way to reducing the cash burden and return the vital resources to our business operation. The bill before you today, Senate 2815, is that solution. As Senator Weber mentioned, the change to the law included in the bill language should simply change the Department of Revenue's Mincare Legend drug tax refund from an annual opportunity to a quarterly opportunity. I want to thank Senator Weber and other co-authors on the bill and the Department of Revenue for working with us. I hope you will support this needed and reasonable change. I'm happy to try and answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much. Members, do you have any questions about Senator Weber's bill or comments? Senator Port.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Weber. This seems to make a whole lot of sense. My only question is, I don't see a fiscal note here. I'm assuming, since you worked with the commissioner, that if there's any additional cost for doing this more frequently, that that would be able to be absorbed by the department?
Senator Weber.
Madam Chair and Senator Port, yes, we have received a revenue estimate from the department, and it is a zero cost estimate.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, it does seem like a reasonable way to help help in this situation. I wasn't aware of how that all worked, so I appreciate the information today and understanding it better. So this bill, we will, members, we will be sending back to, or sending to taxes. So the motion, Senator Utke moves that Senate file 2815 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Taxes. Members, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion does prevail, and Senate file 2815 is passed and referred to taxes.
Madam Chair, members, thank you.
Thank you. Now we will go to Senator Kupek. Good morning, Senator Kupek. You have Senate File 3121.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This bill aims to update the regulations for pharmacy interns by introducing an annual renewal process and will further allow pharmacy students to attain intern status as soon as they begin the Doctor of Pharmacy program. An annual renewal for pharmacy interns is consistent with the Board of Pharmacy standard practice, and it's roughly 26,000 other licensed and registrants. Allowing pharmacy students to register as interns earlier, also in the curriculum, aligns with what has been permitted in more than 40 other jurisdictions. Minnesota is home to one single college of pharmacy. It is located at the University of Minnesota. The Board of Pharmacy staff have collaborated closely with the college's faculty to simplify and improve procedures. As stated in the college's letter of support, the proposed changes are student-friendly, college-friendly, and work to safeguard the public.
Thank you. And we have a testifier on Zoom, Aaron Patterson. If you can please state your name for the record and begin your testimony. And I think you need to unmute.
Thank you. Sorry about that. Good morning, Senators. Chair Wicklund, thank you, Senator Kupek. I'm Aaron Patterson. I am the current interim executive director of the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy. As Senator Kupek stated, the board's been working closely with the University of Minnesota College of Pharmacy to address the recent changes in pharmacy curriculum and education standards and how Minnesota's rules affect those changes. Under current rules, intern credentials never expire. And so it's important to keep that in mind that for all of our other licensees, including facilities and individuals, each maintains an annual renewal as a standard of practice. Consequently, the intern registration becomes an outlier in our jurisdiction. This bill repeals certain rule language in favor of placing updated language in the statutes. Section 1 of the bill modifies the definition for pharmacist intern and expands the definition to include additional scenarios from language previously found in the rule on the matter. Section 2 amends the application fee of $25 into the place of the current fee, $75. Section 3 adds an annual registration renewal fee of $25, beginning in January 1st of 2026. Section 4 then creates a framework for lapsed credentials to be reinstated in the same manner that other Board of Pharmacy credentials can be reinstated. And Section 5 establishes conditions which must be met for the intern to renew annually. It establishes an annual date of expiration, which is September 30th, or upon pharmacist licensure. It establishes the annual fee, late fee process, and ensures that all of the conditions are met, including that an intern is enrolled in an ACPE-accredited College of Pharmacy like the Minnesota College of Pharmacy. The individual maintains notices of employment and training, provides progress report affidavits, and meets the criteria required to either pursue a degree in pharmacy or is completing a residency or fellowship. Section 6 finally modifies how the requisite 1,600 credit hours as an intern can be met starting in year one of pharmacy school, and it removes the requirement for certain types of practice experiences in favor of meeting the new education accreditation standards, and finally repeals the rules dealing with those matters. Thank you for the opportunity to be here to present these changes.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions about the bill? I see no questions. Senator Kupek, this seems like a good way to facilitate having interns participate. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, just add that it's a good way to streamline it, and also I like the fact that it allows people to get into internships quicker in their college career. So,
yeah, that seems like a benefit. So Senate File 3121 will be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Thank you. And next we have is Senator Rarick. Yes. Senator Rarick, Senate File 2819. Welcome to the committee, Senator Rarick. I do see that you have an amendment. This isn't the committee of origin for this bill. It's been to a couple other committees. So if we'll be able to take up your amendment, but if you can go through and describe the bill first, and then we can talk about the amendment.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Senate File 2819 is a bill in response to, I'll start. In 2023, we put a moratorium in place for any new green burial cemeteries in Minnesota, or this would be burying bodies that are not embalmed. When we did the moratorium, we also had the Department of Human Services do a study. So they took some information that came from a green burial organization and also looked around the country as to what other states are doing with green burials. And so the report that they came out with in February is basically what this bill is based upon. It has things like minimum burial depths. We chose the minimum 3.5 feet in the study looking at what is recommended by the green burial groups, that 3.5 to 4 feet is that where your prime decomposition happens. We also put in other parameters like setbacks from property lines, distances from water, all that come from the report and looking at what other states are doing. So I can get into more of those specifics if you wish, Madam Chair, but basically everything that is left in the bill is coming from that report that MDH did looking around what are basically best practices within the industry. What we did discover in the Commerce Committee, which the amendment is getting at, is we did not put an effective date, which would mean this would have an effective date of August 1st, but the moratorium ends on July 1st. So the amendment is just adding an effective date of July 1st so that these provisions would take effect when the moratorium expires.
Thank you. And members, you do have a copy of the study in your packet this morning, so you have all of the details if you wish to refer to them. If we could take up the amendment, Senator Utke, can you move the, Senator Utke moves the A5 amendment. Members, do you have any questions about the amendment? Just sets the effective date. Seeing no questions, all those in favor of the A5 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The A5 amendment is adopted. And now we'll go to testimony. I have Eric Braun and Dan Reed. Whoever would like to go first, if you could please state your name for the record and begin.
My name is Dan Reed, and I'm a commissioner for Carlton County. And I thank you for the opportunity to address the issue of the green burials. We come from a history in Frontier, Minnesota, where death resulted in a burial in the backyard of a farmhouse or in a field. I remember the old ones telling stories of family or neighbors unable to be buried in a cemetery because one didn't exist or they had to travel for a day before they got to a place where there was a cemetery. When I was young, my family went to the sauna at the farm my great-grandmother had settled. And the story was told to me that her first husband, being killed by a wild gun, a rifle with a string pulled across a deer trail for harvesting game, he walked into his own gun on a frosty morning and died. He was carried to the home site and buried by hand, and there was a tree always there that marked where that grave was. And they'd say, oh, there he is, there he is. Times have changed. More people live or recreate in our rural areas. In my very rural area of Western Carlton County, within a radius of 10 miles of the land that I have lived on for 55 years, There is approximately 21 cemeteries, some large, some small, some having only 30 burials in them, some only have 10. Most started by churches or townships. Two of them are co-op cemeteries, started by co-op association. And the burials were once done by undertakers, but now mostly people are cremated. I have shoveled by hand several of them. Those that live full-time in our rural areas are being replaced by the people that use the land to recreate or to retire up north. In time, care for these many cemeteries, according to the laws that I have seen, it first passes to the township where the cemetery is located, and if that fails in time, as our rural areas keep losing population, then it becomes the responsibility of the county. Private for-profit cemeteries are starting to appear. Weigh your decisions carefully and look to the future. The care of these cemeteries will shift to the local governments. Thank you, and we'd like to thank Jason Rarick, our senator, for carrying this bill.
Thank you. And Mr. Braun?
I'm Eric Braun. I'm a Carlton County resident. First of all, Chairman Wicklund and committee, thank you. I'd like to take the opportunity first and foremost to thank you for the work that seeing the green burial moratorium put into place and the resulting MDH study that came as a result of that. Secondly, I'd like to thank you for consideration of this bill. Quite possibly, you've heard testimony and other committee hearings, this bill that green burials are as old as death itself. And I heard Commissioner Reed speak of his grandfather being buried under a big elm tree just yesterday. It is undeniable. Green burials have been around forever, but only as a method of burial, not as an industry or business as we are seeing it emerge. The Green Burial Council, one of the leading advocates for the green burial movement, confirmed this. On their website, they themselves speak of being a growing industry, with the first conservation cemetery being established in 1998 in Westminster, California, I'm sorry, Westminster, South Carolina, by Dr. William and Kimberly Campbell. To quote their founder, Joe Sihe, "In the spring of 2005, I founded the Green Burial Council to establish standards within the growing green burial movement. Today, the organization has grown to become the standard bearer and lead steward of the growing environmental, social, consumer, green burial movement to ensure that our end-of-life practices and the facilities, products, and practices associated with them further legitimize environmental aims. In the 2 years that have passed since I first sat before this council, this committee, because a green cemetery was being proposed in my neighborhood, I've learned a lot. I'm still opposed to it, but for much different reasons. 2 years ago, my opposition was emotional. To use Representative John Hewitt's words, it was because of the ick factor. Today, it's based upon the MDH study. And if my reading and understanding of the Green Burial Council's recommendations on site locations is correct, they would be opposed to it as well. But I must tell you, a green burial has become a very attractive possibility for me as I look down the road. I'm getting closer to that day every day. Finally, I believe this bill is in harmony with the ideals of the Green Burial Council. This bill would provide a statewide framework upon which individual counties will be able to build a superstructure to safely invite and incorporate this growing industry into their communities. Thank you for your time today, and I do thank Senator Rarick for his work on this as well. Thank you.
Thank you. And I have one more testifier, Matt Connell, if you could. Welcome to the committee, and if you can state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chair Wicklund and members of the committee. I'm Matt Connell, caretaker of Loving Earth Memorial Gardens in Carlton County. And it's no secret I was not a fan of the moratorium on natural burial. But I've been thinking hard on this over the past week. I realize that there are, if this bill is passed, reasons to be grateful. We can rest assured that natural burial is the right direction for Minnesota. While proposed regulations in this bill are new for Minnesota, these practices are already commonly applied to green cemeteries around the world, and Loving Earth is no exception. We do what we do out of a deep concern for the planet and the people who live on it. It is, and it's always been, our goal to eliminate any threats of possible environmental damage due to death care practices, while providing a beautiful resting place for our friends and loved ones. But I get it. It's understandable for people to worry about something they perceive as new, but I'm glad that if this bill passes, so many people who at first were concerned about how green burial could affect the environment will now know and understand that we now have this beautiful end-of-life option, where our last physical act on this earth will have a positive impact on the world they leave behind. I'm also grateful that what we want to happen to our bodies when we die, while still not exactly the easiest topic of conversation, is now being discussed at dinner tables across the state. And natural burial is coming up. I think that if passed, this bill can give others with concerns confidence in knowing natural burial is well-regulated, is a legitimate end-of-life option, and is the right choice for the environment. As a side note, we don't have to wait until we die to make those kinds of choices. It's powerful to think about how great an impact we can have by simply researching before making decisions and purchases, and living in a caring way that's mindful of the future generations who will follow us. We Americans love to complain about who's in charge, not realizing that the real strength of community is in the decisions we make for ourselves. We wait for someone to come and save us, but the truth is that we each have choices, and the choices we make matter, and our end-of-life decisions are no exception. This bill is well-written and reasonable. While I did initially state my feelings that the bill is unnecessary, I'm grateful for Senator Rarick's flexibility and willingness to discuss concerns with certain aspects of the original bill. Thank you, Senator Rarick. I appreciate it greatly. To everyone, I hope that if this bill is passed, we can move forward into the future with a better understanding of natural burial and for one another. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, do you have questions or comments about the bill? Senator Abler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And everything I learned about green burial, I learned sitting in a chair right here. It never comes up in topics otherwise, but it is really, you know, fascinating on a scientific basis and on a, you know, personal basis and opportunities and also. And I just have a question I just was reading it about scattering of ashes and stuff. We did that for my aunt and frankly my son. And so you can still do that wherever you want. We had a cabin and took some to Alaska and so on. And so this doesn't interfere with people doing that because nobody really cares or knows. But this is just if you want to have an official place and then you'd have a little plaque or something on these private burial grounds or something.
Senator Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Abler, this is meant for, so if you, in this situation where they're having a cemetery specifically meant for, well, and I guess any cemetery actually, if you're gonna have a place where ashes are scattered, you're gonna wanna make, you're doing it in a specific spot so that others who come to the cemetery understand that, and it's not just gonna be anywhere within the cemetery that somebody could be passing through. We'd want a specific spot where that would be done just so people are fully aware that has happened there. And I don't know that there would be a specific plaque. That would be up to each cemetery to kind of do that. But just for any of that scattering, it would be in a specific spot so it's not just happening wherever.
Senator Abler.
I think that's really cool. And thank you.
Any other member questions or comments? Senator Edke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And not so much about the bill, but the plans for the bill. Do we know what's the plan at this point? I think this has reached the end of its hearing list. Is it going to the floor? Or?
Senator Edke, we plan to lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Can it go directly to the floor? I know that's kind of the request of the author because there is no cost.
I don't know if MDH would have any comment on implementation of the bill. Whether there would be a cost. Good morning. Thank you for coming to the table. If you can state your name and answer the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm Jill Freudenwald. I'm a policy specialist at the Department of Health. We have received a fiscal note request and we're working on it, but we don't anticipate that there would be any cost.
Okay, thank you. Well, Senator Edke, I guess I had just planned on, because it came in, you know, this was fairly late in our process, so I assumed we would request the fiscal note and try and find out, but I don't have a strong feeling about it. Senator Oettke.
I guess that, just for clarity, do you, were you saying it could go to the floor, or you'd rather that it not? I mean, being that the department now has stated that they don't foresee any costs.
Mm-hmm. Senator Oettke, since hearing that, I don't anticipate that there would be a cost. I think if you want, we can refer, we can have it pass and go to the floor.
Madam Chair, if I could ask Senator Rarick, the author, is that your preference that it go to the floor? I've understood it as, but we should hear it from you first.
Senator Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Oettke, I have been speaking with the leadership folks. They were a little more, their preference was to be in an omnibus bill, and I think because so many folks are okay with it as it is, it would be nice if it had the option to be there, but I'm comfortable with it just being laid over. It doesn't, either path is fine for me.
Okay. Madam Chair, I will I'll back off on that. I understood that the author would like to have had it run to the floor on its own, but the omnibus bill sounds like a good place for it, so thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other member comments, questions? Senator Hoffman.
Hello, Madam Chair. What is the one thing I always ask you at the end of one of my bills? Send it to the floor. I'm over here just giggling because this is like, I would be like, let's go to the floor on this one. So I'm thank you. That's all.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Rarick, for your work on this. I appreciate that, we have had good discussions over time, and we've tried to involve as many of the stakeholders to find out. I think it was helpful to get the information that MDH put together so we have that to base our decisions on. And again, appreciate your willingness to work on this over the last few weeks here. So Senate file 2819, I'm sorry, did you have any other final comments, Senator Berg?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just real quick, this, was never meant, when we did the moratorium originally, was never meant to stop green burials from happening. It was just about getting some information in front of us, just like we have here in this report, so we could just make some common sense provisions for people to follow. Do I wish we'd have had that report, say, back in October, so we could have involved folks sooner? But the one thing I will say, when you put a bill in, folks pay attention and they come out, and it was very good. We worked with folks from the Muslim community, the Jewish community, to make sure we weren't infringing on any of their traditions. Worked with cemeteries and funeral directors to make sure we weren't causing problems there. So what we have in front of us is that product, and I think it is the right thing for Minnesota moving forward so that we can have green burials, but that it's being done right. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, and I hope that it does help us facilitate, communities across the state having that guidance, and then they can facilitate any work that they need to do within their governmental entities. So thank you, Senator Rarick. Senate file 2819, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now we move to Senator Hoffman. Senate file 1676.
Stick around.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It says here the disposition is layover, but if you find it in your heart to send it to the floor, I won't ask you at the end of this, but I want to thank Senator Rarick. You got to ask ahead of time, Senator Oettke. I want to thank Senator Rarick for being a co-author on this one, and I want to think there are three. Senator Rarick is number one. Number two, the previous chief author of this was Senator Carla Nelson, and she knows this agency very well. Before she served in the Senate, she was appointed to this agency, and it's a small agency, by Governor Tim Pawlenty. And third, I want to thank you, Chair Wicklund, for hearing this agency bill. The Minnesota Higher Education Facilities Authority, MHEFA, is a very small state agency. As a matter of fact, there's only two employees, and they get $0 from the general fund. They are funded entirely by user fees. Currently, MAHIFA serves Minnesota's higher education institutions such as St. Thomas, Hamline, and Gustavus. This bill allows the Minnesota nonprofit healthcare institutions to access this great state agency. It's a diamond in, it's been around, and it's a diamond in our state work. Minnesota private colleges use MAHIFA because they can get cheaper financing for their building projects like science labs or college dorms. What we want to do, especially in our human services world, we always talk about capacity, is to give hospitals, nursing homes, and clinics the same opportunity at cheaper financing for their building projects. There are 14 other states currently, Madam Chair, that have this available product available to them at the same service to those nonprofit healthcare industries. And this is one small thing we can do to support our healthcare institutions. As you know, it's been a topic of concern for all of us. It will be especially useful in greater Minnesota, where our CANF funds are much needed, but this would be an absolute great need out there. I'm not aware of any opposition to this bill, and I'm now happy. I want to turn things over to Barry Fick, who's the executive director of MAHIFA. And so there you go, Madam Chair. And also in your members, there should be letters of support that are in there, and then there's a need for an expansion document in your paper as well. So, Barry.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Barry Fick, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Higher Education Facilities Authority, and I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee today. As Senator Hoffman noted, we are a very small state agency. We've been around since 1972, and in that time frame, we have accomplished 253 financings with over $3.57 billion of debt issued to date. Right now, we have 48 bond issues outstanding for 17 private schools in the state with a par value of about $1.2 billion outstanding as of today. We function as a conduit borrower, which is to say we issue the debt and then loan the proceeds to the borrower that will then repay that money. We are not responsible for repayment, nor is the state responsible for any of that repayment. We are completely independent. The fiscal note that we prepared has shown that we have zero effect on the state budget. We receive zero state or federal support. And I think it's additionally important for the committee to realize that the work we do is independent of the state in terms of we do not affect the state's bonding capacity, we do not affect the credit rating of the state, and we do not obligate the state in any way, shape, or form to make any repayment should one of our borrowers fail to make their own repayment, which they never have in the 52 years that we've been in operation. So we are funded 100% by operating fees that we assess to the borrowers, and we think that this bill would be very beneficial for the authority. We had originally started a few years ago when we received requests from various healthcare agencies if we could help them with financing. At that time, we were not able to do that, of course, so we introduced this bill, and we have continued to receive requests from those folks to see if we would be able to assist them. As Senator Hoffman noted, the Minnesota Private College Council is in favor of this expansion, and it would be a strong benefit, we believe, for both rural Minnesota, for urban Minnesota, and for the state in general. So I'd be pleased to respond to any questions or comments that members might have.
Thank you very much. Members, do you have any questions about the bill? Senator Utke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just, in the back of my head, we've been talking about this for a few years, haven't we? This was a few years ago, I think, we had the same conversation.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for confirming, because I'm going, I've heard this, but I was just trying to place it. But it was good then, and it's good now, so thank you.
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, and I thought I was going to get the Senator Utke question on, you know, what is the cost to the state? And I wrote on a piece of paper what Senator Abler last night showed us on another cost. It's that cost right there, Madam Chair. So, this is the same conversation we've been having, Madam Chair. So, yes, it's time to send it to the floor and be done with it. So.
Any other member questions, comments? Senator Hoffman, we won't send it to the floor, but we will lay Senate File 1676 over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
Next, we will move to Senate File 2986. Senator Wicklund, when you are ready, please begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 2986 is a very technical bill. It's not intended to change any current statutory requirements, but instead aims to simply reformat current statutory requirements for purposes of increased clarity. Current Minnesota Statute Section 256B.0622 regulates two distinct and separate mental health services: intensive residential treatment services and assertive community treatment. The fact that the regulations for these two separate services are intertwined together in statute has caused confusion over the years. Senate File 2986 separates out these two separate mental health services into two separate sections of statute. This will allow for increased clarity for stakeholders in future legislative sessions when statutory changes are proposed for either of these two mental health services. And I will stop there. If there are specific technical questions, I'm hoping that Senate Counsel will be able to help me with that.
Very good. Questions or comments, members? Seeing none, any closing comments, Senator Wicklund?
No, I think that, you know, when we can make things more clear, when we have services like this, I think it's a good idea to take the time to, you know, recodify them and make sure that everybody has that clarity.
Absolutely. Senator Abler.
Yeah, sorry to step on your closing, your dramatic close there.
Yes.
I just wanted to, maybe the reviser people are watching, they work really hard. The level of detail they go to, I need detailed people in my life, and that's what they are here. And resorting these statutes every so often, it's just a real service, and they're good at it, and they probably actually enjoy that level of detail. So I just want to thank them for their efforts, you know, for the bill. Thanks.
Thank you for raising that, Senator Abler. All right, with that, Senate File 2986 will be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus. Next, we will go to Senate File 2127. Senator Wicklund.
Great. Senate File 2127 relates to a professional area, central service technicians. And today's surgical instruments are highly complex and ever-changing, with intricate designs that include tiny channels and crevices where debris can easily hide. Despite this, central service technicians who are responsible for cleaning, sterilizing, and preparing these instruments often receive little to no formal training, yet they are expected to handle and know up to 37,000 different surgical instruments. So who are central service technicians? These professionals play a critical role in patient safety by ensuring that every instrument used in surgery is properly disassembled, cleaned, inspected, sterilized, and reassembled before it ever touches a patient. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there are approximately 1,300 central service technicians in Minnesota, each one essential to maintaining safe surgical environments. But here's the issue that we are facing with and trying to resolve with this bill. This profession is unregulated. Right now, a person could be hired off the street to sterilize these surgical instruments. No training or certification is required. And then those instruments are used to perform procedures on patients. Those same instruments are then used in life-saving procedures. This lack of oversight has real consequences. Minnesota has already seen multiple outbreaks caused by improperly cleaned surgical instruments. In one alarming case, a medical center had to notify 100 patients that they had been exposed to unsterilized instruments. These kinds of mistakes put lives at risk and undermine trust patients place in our healthcare system. By implementing standards and training requirements for central service technicians, we can protect patients, prevent dangerous infections, and ensure that the tools used in surgery are as safe as the procedures themselves. And Madam Chair, I do have an author's amendment that I would like to adopt, the A1.
Senator Wicklund moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion carries. The amendment is adopted. Senator Wicklund.
And I'd like to have my testifiers proceed and then can answer any questions.
Very good. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Josephine Colacci, and I am Director of Government Affairs for the Healthcare Sterile Processing Association. HSPA represents over 50,000 central service technicians in the U.S. and abroad. And the legislation that's before you is very similar to what has been adopted by six other states across the country. Those states are New York, Connecticut, Delaware, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, and New Jersey. And with that, I'm going to turn over my comments to Matt.
Mr. Tell, please introduce yourself and begin.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Matthew Thell. I'm a program manager for high-level disinfection and sterilization for a healthcare organization in Minnesota. I also serve as the chapter president for the Minnesota Sterile Processing Association. Just to reiterate a little bit of the complexity that these central service technicians go through on a daily basis. They're handling hundreds of instruments per day on a shift. Just to highlight that a little bit, one flexible endoscope that can be used in a healthcare facility can take up to 118 different cleaning steps to properly clean and disinfect it before it's used on another patient. This can happen up to 20 times a day and per shift. In addition to that, a 15 OR, or operating room hospital, can have about 13,000 cases a year. This would translate into roughly about 1.2 million different instruments that have to be handled by these technicians daily. So the role that they play in infection prevention in our healthcare settings is critical. So we would strongly support and ask for support on them requiring this certification. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Wicklund.
Madam Chair, the bill lays out, it defines the service technicians, what it means to be a healthcare practitioner, and then it lays out requirements for the central service technician to pass a nationally accredited examination and also to maintain credentials in one of the following nationally accredited areas, I guess, of focus. And then there is a delay in terms of the implementation process. So all people who are employed in this field right now are excluded from the regulation, and new hires, they have 24 months from the date of hire to obtain the certified registered central service technician credential. And then that doesn't actually go into effect. This section isn't effective until 180 days after the enactment. So we're not trying to rush people into this, but I do think that having some foundational standards and opportunities for people to get training and focus will be beneficial for this field. And I have been asking questions about access to training. I think what I'm hearing from Josephine is that there is a lot of free training available. There's manufacturers provide training. So the access to training opportunities is there. There are modest fees for the tests, but I think having some foundational standards is warranted. I was able to tour a facility. There might be others on the committee who have done so as well, and that was really enlightening to me. I've never been in that part of a hospital, and it was really amazing the work that goes into taking back in, you know, dirty instruments, and then getting them sorted and cleaned, and then repackaged in sterile containers, ready to go back out again. And it's really quite a very fascinating process. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Port.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Wicklund. This is one of those things that you don't think about how it happens, just that there's sterile instruments. So I appreciate the thoughtfulness. We should always be trying to make healthcare encounters safer for people, for patients. So I think this is a great idea. I love, you know, that you have made sure that there are opportunities for people. We can certainly keep an eye on that as we move forward and make sure that that continues to be true. But I think this makes a ton of sense. It's not something I would have thought about us needing, but it clearly is. So appreciate you bringing it forward.
Other questions or comments? Senator Utke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. As Senator Wicklund said, she got to tour it, so did I, and I think, I don't know if others did also, but what an eye-opening process, and to be able to see, you know, the attention to detail and the organization of how this goes through. Somebody who's never been into that part of a medical facility, it was eye-opening in the fact that you just think those things happen all on their own, but they don't. It takes people that have to, you know, attend to every last little detail to make sure that the tools that are being used are properly sterilized, etc. So I thank those that allowed me to take that tour and get to see what you all do. It was great, and I'm happy to see this bill moving forward. So thank you.
Senator Abler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and like Senator Porter, I don't wake up thinking about this, but the 110 steps to clean a colonoscope reminds me of a Seinfeld episode that I saw. But anyway, never mind. But so it makes sense, and I appreciate professionalism. Just to have the question on worrying about fencing people out. Are there enough of you to go around? It seems to me, just like to the bill, the hospital's under so much regulation anyway to look after this. They have a duty to make sure people are trained, and I don't oppose the bill. I don't have an opinion on it. It's fine by me if you want to do it, but I don't see the hospitals here to worry about it. But I just, as we set up all these credentialing things, in a world where there's not enough humans to go around to do much of anything going forward, I just want to caution you that you might get what you want, and then you'll have all these people that are credentialed and not enough people to do a surgery. So maybe you could comment about that.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So I'll use this as an example. The second state to require it was New York in 2013, and then all of the subsequent states after that came. And so I can only explain that since those states have gone into effect, and they also had grandfather clauses in them, allowing all the current techs to not have to be required to be certified. And then in some of those states, it's a 2-year from the date of hire to obtain the certification. In some other states, it's 18 months from the date of hire. From that time period, 2013 to now, we haven't heard that they haven't had enough techs in any of those states. That feedback has not gotten back to us, so that's really the only answer I could give you. And in the current states that have statutes, they have not been rolled back or partially tried to be repealed, or they're still in the same way as they were originally adopted.
Senator Abler.
Well, and that's, I get it, and I, you know, it's kind of early, but I, you know, maybe the professionalism will draw people to stay and they'll have some pride. I mean, I favor credentialing, but there's always a, you have to always ask the question, are we going to harm the capacity that we're trying to actually help? So I'll just raise the thing, and so you can comment again if you want. Yeah. I'm not objecting to the bill. I'm just
This is Go anecdotal, ahead. Of course, and we have pending legislation in the state of Florida in a hospital in Miami that we took legislators on a tour. It actually came up that they put in requirements for certification in that particular hospital because they saw higher retention rates from the techs. Again, it's one hospital in a different state, and it is anecdotal, but you know, that's an example for you. Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, just
Senator Abler.
Madam Chair. So, I mean, there might be a bill someday to give people a little more time to work. I mean, so I wish you the best, and I appreciate, I had no idea there's so many steps. That's incredible. Anyway, so thanks, Madam Chair. I'm done.
Any other questions or comments? I'll just end with thank you. I mean, this is also, you know, one of those things that I think we just assume happens in the background and don't really think about, but is incredibly important and has potentially really serious consequences if it does not go well or is done right. And so I think putting some systems and processes in place to be sure that we have that level of training and professionalism and standard is the right thing. So thank you for being thoughtful about how we do that and moving forward. Any closing comments? Senator Wicklund.
No, Madam Chair. I think it is a balance, and I think that we have put thought into how it can be implemented here without disruption, and I do think that it can be a way to attract more people to the field, and I hope that, you know, as time goes on, if we learn of other reasons that this is proving difficult, that we'll hear feedback and we can take, you know, think about other actions, so... Thank you.
Thank you. With that, Senate File 2127 is laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, we will move next to Senate File 2988. Senator Wicklund, when you are ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry, which one are we
2988.
Madam Chair, these next bills are kind of familiar this time of year, vehicle bills that we are bringing forward so that we have opportunities. And they are in themselves not much to talk about, but are something that we need to have in place. So I don't know if members have any questions about 2988, but that is the reason for the next three bills.
Very good. Members, any questions about 2988? Seeing none, I believe the motion would be for Senate File 2988 be recommended to pass and be sent to the floor.
Okay, is that? All right. I don't have my... You can just say
recommended to pass. Okay, very good. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion carries. Bill passes. Next, we'll go to 2990.
Senate File 2990 is another bill that has very minor updates and will be also available for us in conjunction with the other body. So,
very good. So. Members, any questions about this bill? All right, Senate File 2990 is recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion carries. The bill is on its way. And number three, then, Senator Wicklund, Senate File 3137.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Similarly, little changes in this bill, and I should say, I guess I could have said to be more clear, we have different bills because we have jurisdiction over so many different areas, and these are in different areas. So this one relates to childcare. And the others are relating to other areas in our jurisdiction. So,
very good. Members, questions about this one? Seeing none, Senate File 3137. The motion is for Senate File 3137 be recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? Motion carries. And the bill is on its way. And with that, we are at the end of our agenda, and this meeting is adjourned.